Session number 26580.
Wing Commander, Jerry Roberts, Reel 2. Now, we got to the point where when you left Cranmore, you got a rather surprising posting, or surprising to you, because in November 1940, you were sent to number 2 navigation school at Craneage.
Craneage in Cheshire. Craneage in Cheshire was a brand new airfield, and a terrible come down from Cranmore. In Cranmore, we lived in what still was the peacetime mess, with marvellous food and white tablecloths. And in fact, at Cranwell, I had what I only achieved once later as a wing commander, and that is half a civilian batman as a sovereign pilot, age 19. Anyway, Craneage was still being completed, and we lived in huts with no running water. The running water was outside, and there was no hot water, and it was frozen outside, so it was a very, very uncomfortable place. The reason why we went to Cranmore was because the RAF was short of navigators, and also the Hamblin Force, which is number 5 group, didn't have a second pilot, and so they thought it would be a good idea to train pilots as navigators and make them do the first 7 or so trips over Germany or wherever as a navigator. So to some extent, it was, you know, looking at it in later life, it was very useful because it was an additional skill, qualified skill, recorded skill, which perhaps a lot of people didn't have.
Now, how did they go about training you as a navigator?
Well, we stuck us in the back of... Well, I mean, we had ground lectures about navigation, but they stuck us in the back of an Anson and made us navigate.
Now, what were the navigational tools in use then, if you remember?
Well, I mean, only a chart and a pair of parallel rulers and a pencil, rubber... Oh, and a slide rule, circular slide rule.
And how did you use these things? I mean, what exactly was it? Just dead reckoning, or?
Well, I think one had to get down and take drifts if one could.
Drifts being?
Well, you look down and discovered whether the aircraft was crabbing sideways or not.
Caused by the wind.
Caused by the wind. That's right. And, of course, being November and in England, it was pretty, pretty grim weather, you know, cloudy and misty and altogether not a very pleasant time.
Did you have any problems with the maths of navigation? I mean,
no.
You were assigned to Ben, so I presume not.
No, no problems. Maps are very good.
So anything else about your time there? I mean, your autobiography, which I think there's a copy deposited at the RAF Museum, does make it quite clear you didn't enjoy this period.
Well, no, I mean, I was doing what I wasn't supposed to be doing, which was I was supposed to be flying as a pilot, not learning to be a navigator. But I mean, it was the whole discomfort of an overcrowded science mess with no hot water and not sufficient heat in the accommodation.
So what was next then?
Well, we then went on to Cottesmore, RAF Cottesmore.
Now what was
which
this?
Which is still a live and active station even now. This was an operational training unit, an OTU, where we went to learn to fly Hamblins.
Now, tell us about that. Learning to fly the Hamblin. What was the characteristics of the Hamblin?
The Hamblin
you
was...
Did you do some... And some flying there as well?
We started off just... It was supposed... Having done a navigation course, they supposed we need some refresher flying. So that was the Anson little bit of it.
What was the Anson like to fly? You don't remember. Yeah, it's not your thing. Yeah, it's all right. So what about learning to fly the Hampden? I don't know whether you seem to have done that a fair bit of the Hampden flying, so perhaps you could talk to us a bit about the Hampden when we'd like to.
Well, the Hampden, of course, when one first got, you know, this seemed to be a real aeroplane, because you hear the engines and it's like listening to one of those Italian racing cars or something. There was a bit of power there, one sensed. Now the Hampden, of course, didn't have any dual controls. So first of all, they had a Hampden in the hangar, supported anyway, in which you sat in the cockpit and operated the controls as though you were flying, with an instructor there, including retracting and lowering the undercarriage. And then you went and sat behind a staff pilot while he did a few circuits and bumps, and then you went on your own. Now my instructor on that occasion was John Nettleton, who got a VC on the Augsburg grade, if you recall.
What was he like?
He's a South African. But I don't know, because, I mean, he was in the officer's mess, I was in the sergeant's mess.
So you just knew he was there?
Yeah.
It seems you were on the link trainer as well.
Well, yes, I think we did link trainer all through.
What was the link trainer? Because they don't have, people don't know what they are now.
Well, it was a tiny little machine, you know, or artificial wings and what have you, with all flying instruments, and you put the hood down and operated the controls, and so it affected the instruments accordingly, so you could fly.
Was it realistic?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yes, I think so.
So it was a valuable training addition to your training.
They wouldn't have continued it so long. I mean, you know, these days, of course, as a development from the Link, they have these trainers, big electronic jobs.
The Hampden, can you perhaps go into a little more detail about what it was actually like, the layout of the machine and what it was like to fly?
Well, the Hampden had two engines, Bristol engines. The cockpit, I suppose, was about 3'6" wide. The whole aircraft was about 3'6" wide, that's all. It had a four crew, a pilot, a navigator, a rear gunner, and a radio operator, rear gunner. It was the nicest aircraft I flew in the whole of my career, a beautiful aircraft.
What was so beautiful about it?
Well, its handling. It had wing slats, until they tightened them, made them solid, because they put balloon cutter things on the front of the wings. But it was a beautiful aircraft to fly.
Now, where did you all sit in it? Because it sounds very narrow. I mean, where did the crew actually sit?
Well, the pilot sat in the pilot seat, the navigator was in the glass nose, and you've got a picture there. And the two gunners were at the rear of fuselage.
And what about the automatic pilot?
Yes, we did have an automatic pilot, which was useful, except that it was prone to a sudden dirty dive to the left.
What caused that?
I've no idea. I suppose the gyro toppled. But I mean, you know, you could get hold of the machine again and reset it, and it was all right.
You seem to have done quite a lot of work on instrument flying again. Now, what were the instruments like in the Hampden for instrument flying?
Well, it's a standard British blind flying panel.
Which is?
Well, you've got an airspeed indicator, an artificial horizon. Oh, I can't. It's no good talking about it now. I can't remember. Okay, I mean, it's all so familiar to me, but the words.
No, that's fair enough. You also did some. You did a couple of flights as a navigator bomb aimer. Do you remember those? Or
Yes, because they recalled that we were still going to operate as navigators, bomb aimers, so they gave us some flying at that.
Do you remember how you did the bombing? What mechanism they had for accuracy?
We had a bomb sight, but I can't remember much about it. We bombed at a range of Wool Fox Lodge, which was on the other side of the Great North Road. Therein lies a tragedy. But on my the last trip I was going to do, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and the aircraft I was going to go up in came into the circuit and flew halfway around the circuit, and then suddenly there was a great fire on the ground, and the chief flying instructor, or at least the flight commander who was in charge of night flying that night, was going to set off in his car, and I asked if I could come with him, and we got onto the Great North Road and went north for, I don't know, a mile, 2 or 3 miles, I suppose, and there was this fire. We went up a farmer's lane and to a gate, and there was a Hamden on the ground in flames. We found the pilot about 200 yards from the aircraft, apparently undamaged but dead. And my friend, who was, I think, was sitting behind the pilot seat, was there and engulfed in flames. Nothing you could do about it, too late. That was a great sort of tragedy to finish up the course.
Did it affect your nerve at all?
No, I don't think it did. I was a bit shaken the next day, and we went to another fellow and I had a cycle ride out to a pub and got the day off, but it didn't affect my flying at all.
Was there any sort of assessment test at the end of your time at number 14 operational training unit, or Cottesmore?
Not that I recall.
So your next posting would be in April, the back end of April 1941, when you went to number 106 squadron at Coningsby.
That's right.
Lincolnshire.
That's right. Near Boston. Not far from Boston.
And tell me, what did you think of this posting, firstly? Did you have any opinion about it?
Well, no, I mean, it was something that was going to happen ever since I got into training, because it was an operational squadron, and that's where one was going.
And you were going as a bomber navigator.
That's right.
Rather than
pilot. I did my first 7 trips in the nose as a navigator. And whether I was a good navigator or not, I don't know, but we always got home. That's the important thing.
Now, tell me your first impressions of 106 Squadron as a unit when you joined them. I mean, what impression did they make on you as a group of men?
That I can't say. But it does remind me, I'd go back on Cottesmore. While I was at Cottesmore, there were 2 VCs there. Sergeant Hanna was in the sergeant's mess with me, and the other was a South African whose name escapes me for the time being. Babe Learoyd, yes, Babe Learoyd.
But there's nobody you remember from 106 Squadron?
Oh, yes, well, I remember several, yes. I mean, the squadron commander, I believe, was only 23. He was a wing commander, and he had a double DSO and a double DFC.
Do you remember his name?
Not at the moment, but it'll come back, I expect, in a minute. Bob. No, I don't remember.
How did they take you into the unit? You were arriving, you know, as a sergeant, you know.
That's right.
How did they sort of take you in?
No one just slid in. I don't think there's any comment to be made.
There's no briefing.
No.
Training.
No. The problem was to get crewed up.
Now tell me about crewing up.
No, I don't know. I don't recall what happened there at all. But I slid into a crew, and they were all sergeants.
Was that the usual thing, to keep the sergeants together and the officers together? Or?
Not necessarily, I don't think, no.
And do you remember anything about your missions, any of the individual missions as a bomber navigator?
Oh, well, yes, if I can recall them on the spot. The only one I can say as a navigator, I think, was one night we got over Teal. I can't remember what we were supposed to be doing, but we got over Teal, and there wasn't a light or any activity at all. And suddenly a shell burst under the port wing, and that put my Perspex nose, half of it disappeared. And a piece of shrapnel went through the fuselage behind me and in front of me, so, you know, it was a useful escape, that was. So, anyway, we dropped the bombs and went home. It was a bit wet when we got home, so, coming in through an open nose, a bit damp, so we got priority landing, and then we discovered that the port tire had been burst by this shell, and so we spun on the grass, but there was no damage, and I think the aircraft was repaired later. But that was about the most dicey trip I did.
And perhaps I could. Do you remember the mining trips? You went mining. The mining.
I was.
I should have asked you. I should have led you to that first.
No. But I was very fortunate, because mining trips, or particularly later, were very dicey affairs, because the Germans put flagships, and to lay a mine you had to come down to 500 or 1,000 feet, and fly straight and level from a pinpoint to get the mine in exactly the right place, which had to be in a river channel. But fortunately, I believe that we always put the mine where it should have been, and I never had any opposition.
And whereabouts exactly were you mining?
I think we did one or two of the French ports, the Biscay French ports, I don't know, off Holland too, but I can't remember exactly where.
Now, those are the trips you most remember. You don't remember the other ones. Now, how close did you get to the other crew members? I mean, I know you don't remember their name now. It is 60, 70 years ago. Was it a close relationship with the crew?
No, not that I recall. I don't think it was close. There was no animosity. We got on well together, but other than that, I wouldn't say.
Some people have said that it's important that the crews act as a team,
Well, I think that's probably goes for all flying of whatever sort. I mean, particularly in Coast Command, where you've got 12 members of a team in the crew.
So anything else you remember about your time with 206?
We're talking about being a navigator, which I did for 7 trips. And then went back to Cottesmore to ostensibly learn to be a first pilot. But in fact, I'd done an awful lot of flying on the squadron, because there was always somebody be taking somebody, or an air test to be done. There was always some flying, and I flew almost every day, I suppose. In fact, when we got to Cottesmore, I had more hours in than anybody else on the course. Which shows a matter of amount of keenness, I suppose.
You still enjoy flying. You were on the Anson and the Hampden now.
I suppose that they thought that. I don't know. Does it say they're on the Hampden?
It says the Anson. For
Anson.
A while.
Well, just, I suppose
just,
it's just
three serial numbers.
Yes, just a three. A refresher on the assumption that having been a navigator you hadn't done any flying, whereas I had done a lot. But anyway, having done that, I went back to the squadron and got myself a crew.
And do you remember this crew, or do you not remember crews?
I remember this crew, yes. My navigator, he was a proper navigator with an O-wing, but a Canadian Jew. I got on very well with him, Jacobson, I think. My two gunners, I suppose, was, I don't know whether one can say very much about them, but one of them certainly was the driest humorist I've ever come across. Thought he was a Cockney. And the funny thing about that is that not many years ago, I saw in the newspaper a picture of him. And I can't remember why he was there, but I thought I would write to his father. But I managed to find out, not to his father, to his son, I beg his pardon. Yes, to his son. And I managed to find the address in Devizes and wrote. That was much appreciated, that was. Anyway, there we were. As far as remembering trips over Germany and
One thing we would like you to do it now at this point is, I think, to take us through a typical trip, you know, in the sense of what you do at each stage. So if we start with, when would you first find out you were going on a trip? Do you see what I mean? I mean, and what was your first briefing of it?
Yes, I think going into a matter of detail, which doesn't please me very much, because I don't think in such details. Well, I suppose in the crew room, a list was put up of those on operations that night, and later on one went to a briefing.
And what would happen at the briefing, generally?
Well, we'd all sit there and listen to where we were going, the route to be taken, and what other information there was to be had. And eventually one got to the aeroplane, into the aeroplane, and off.
Now, was there any set method of taking off in formation, or one after another?
Oh, no, just as each individual aircraft got ready, off they went.
Now, would you fly as individuals, or would you fly in formation?
No, individuals.
So when
I say that, there was one occasion when there was a formation flight, when fortunately I was on leave. But that was a Hamblin force led by my squadron commander in a daylight operation over Brest. Fortunately, most of them got back. Whereas you'd expect most of them all to be decimated.
So in a typical raid, you just make your own way using your own navigation.
That's right.
To the target.
That's right. Absolutely. And of course, since the weather people didn't know much about the winds, you were stuck with a met wind, and whether you got near the target or not was a matter of some trepidation.
Now, at this stage, they didn't have any of the later sophisticated.
Oh, not at all.
Directional.
No. Entirely on the chart and the navigator and the met wind. Occasionally, you could get a pinpoint. I mean, crossing the coast into Europe, you probably could get a pinpoint. And later on, you may get a pinpoint on a lake or river junction or something. But by and large, one didn't know where one was.
And so you just fly across. Now, you weren't escorted at all. When would you start to run risk of either German light fighters or anti-aircraft? Or when would you start to notice this?
Well, I don't know about noticing it, but I mean, you were at danger as soon as you crossed the coast.
And which was the main danger as far as you were concerned?
Oh, well, over a target, or where you supposed was the target. I was coned over a German city, but I can't remember. Duisburg. I was coned over Duisburg.
Now, what does coned mean?
Well, I don't know. Eight searchlights concentrating on the aircraft. It was more than daylight in the cockpit. At night, it was more than daylight in the cockpit. And then you had shells bursting all round you. You couldn't see the ground, so you had no idea where the target was. And hopefully one eventually escaped.
As you did on that occasion.
Yes.
Now, what about German night fighters? Were you very aware of them, or...
No.
These
were too early days, I think, for German night fighters. There was only one occasion when there might have been a night fighter about, and that was, I don't know where we'd been, but we came back, full moonlight, no clouds, we came back over the centre of Bremen, which was a daft place to be, but there were no guns. We flew over Bremen and Bremerhaven, and they were in broad, full moon, and my gunner said, I think I saw a fighter. But that's the only time in all the 30 trips that fighters were mentioned.
Now, dropping the bombs, would you only drop them if you got to the target, or would you drop them near the target? Or what was your sort of general policy with the way you treated your bomb load?
Well, I think that one dropped bombs when one got into difficulties. One would like to have dropped bombs on the target, but if you couldn't see the target, you know. There's another time when I got coned, and that had other connotations too. We no sooner got off the ground when the raid was cancelled, but the message didn't get to me. And I think the reason why it was cancelled was because there was a very active cold front over Holland, which, you know, with only the few hundred hours that I had, with no experience of active cold fronts, was a very frightening business. Because Snellmo's fire, blue fire, were all round the prop tips and the cockpit glass. Ice slinging off the propellers. And going up, being flung up in the air several hundred feet and then down again. It was very frightening. But having got through that, the North German plane was clear blue sky again. Well, I mean dark. It was dark, but it was absolutely clear, not a cloud in the sky. And I don't think there was a moon. No, there was no moon. But there again I got coned. But having no idea where I was, really, I mean, it must have been somewhere near Hanover, it must have been somewhere near the target, but I couldn't see anything. No, one dropped the bombs and went home again.